Accession number 18267, Real One.
Ray Carriage, Real One, where were you born, please?
Great Yarmouth in Norfolk.
Which year was this?
1931, on the 10th of April.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Great Yarmouth?
Initially, I was evacuated during the war up to, I think it was Lincolnshire.
Where
near
you?
Retford, we had two different births. One for about 6 months, and then we moved to a farm at East Drayton, and then we returned to Yarmouth. The war wasn't over. I can't remember the year we returned. The war wasn't over because there was still severe bombing going on. And one morning when we were on our way to school, it was an early morning raid. They came in straight off the sea. You felt as if you could put your hand in the cockpit. They smashed a bomb through what we always knew as the Green Shelters, which was a seaside shelter. And on that day, they bounced a bomb into one of our local shops and killed one of our school girlfriends. And I believe they hit the old Imperial Hotel down on the seafront and killed 19 or 20 Women's Army racks, is it? Women's Royal Army Corps, yeah.
Do you know the name of the schoolgirl?
Doris Yaxley, I believe, if my memory serves me correctly.
So that might have been 44, do you think?
I think it very likely was.
And you witnessed all this, did you?
I didn't actually witness the bomb hitting her. I was on the seafront and saw the bomb go through the roof of the Green Shelter. It then careered off, went through a roof on a Newtown housing estate, and then carried on and went into the front of Alan Poley's shop, I believe.
What kind of shop was that?
It was a post office and general news agent, I think.
On which road?
Oh, I can't remember now. It's a long while ago. I'm not even sure that my description of what his shop was is correct. It was opposite another school, but I don't even remember the name of that school now.
Was that a frightening experience for you?
At the time, no. I think we were young enough to see these planes at this level. We thought at first they were Spitfires, but then we saw the crosses on them, and I, even to this day, funnily enough, I can still see that damn pilot's face turn around looking down at us, and he waved his hand. And it was, as I said, on the way to school in the morning, so it would have been between 8 and 8.30.
You think the pilot was waving towards to people?
He was waving at us kids. There was a gang of us, you know, in those days you used to trek to school in gangs. The furthest one started off, and when he came to the next house, he'd call his friend out, and we used to end up, by the time we got to school, there'd be about 8 or 9 of us walking together. And after that, I don't really have any serious memories of the Second World War. I mean, I can remember the rationing. I can remember we kept rabbits and chickens, and there was a fair trade going on in chickens, eggs and rabbits in exchange for what goodies other people had. A very good bartering system was running in those days.
Was that in Yarmouth?
Yes. But that really is all the memories I have of the Second World War. There was the nightly bombing, and we spent quite a lot of nights sleeping in the Anderson shelter. There was one night, my father was very loath to sleep in the shelter. He used to chase the family down and then remain in bed. My mother used to shout at me to go and get him up. And one night in particular, there was a lot of noise going on, and the sky almost appeared lit up with flares and one thing or another. I ran upstairs to get him out of bed and told him the town was on fire. And by the time he got out of bed and got to the window, everything had gone quiet. So he said, "You wicked little," and went back to bed.
What do you think public morale was like during the war?
Excellent. I've always felt, not just during the war, I believe there's something about the British race, we just do not believe that we can be beaten. Even when we take a hiding, it seems to be, well, we lost that battle, but we'll get you in the end. I think this was probably what sets us apart from other people. We just, it's not in our makeup to believe that others can do it to us. And I think that was pretty well true in Yarmouth towards the Second World War, that everybody was quite convinced that despite what was going on, he would receive his comeuppance in due course. I felt that there was a great reverence for Churchill. He undoubtedly was the man of the hour and the man of the needs.
Did you ever listen to his speeches?
Quite a lot. And, what was I, about 13, I suppose, then, I'm not sure. And they certainly were extremely gripping and rousing.
Did you ever listen to Lord Haw Haw?
Once or twice. We thought he was a joke. Wasn't his name Joyce? Wasn't he the renegade Englishman?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody took any notice of it.
Do you think the war left you with any long-term effects?
I think it was part of the experience of growing up. It certainly served me in good cause once in career later on, but I think it was just part of growing up. It was the time.
When you were evacuated, was it with the whole school?
Not the whole school. I think it was, there was a if you call them a charabang, but a bus load of us. And we were taken to the station and tagged up and rather like Paddington Bear, sent off into the wide blue yonder. And I had my younger brother with me. And we arrived at, I think, Retford, then Darlington. No, Ranskill was where we ended up. And we were met by these people who were extremely nice, but spoke a language we didn't understand. I remember the woman putting her arm around my shoulder and said, "Come on, my darling, would you like a chucky egg?" And I spent the next half an hour wondering what a chucky egg was. They were very nice. They had a daughter who was about 6 months younger than my younger brother. And I think we were with them for probably a year. And then it got to the stage where they felt that they needed to have us out of the house because they wanted to bring their niece, I think, in as company for their daughter. And we moved to a farm. I think that was East Drayton, and Mrs. Johnson, and old Ben Johnson, her husband, who had no teeth and used to smoke a pipe without a stem so that he could hold it between his lips. And we used to sit there and watch this pipe right underneath his nose and wonder how he could stand the heat. And they had a son who was about 16, and another evacuee staying with them from Birmingham. I don't remember his surname, but I know his name was Lenny. And that was quite a happy time. But I passed a scholarship to go to grammar school. And I was pressurised by one of the teachers from Yarmouth came up to see us. And he said, "Oh, you should go," but I didn't want to leave my brother. So I decided that I wouldn't take up the position. My father and mother left it entirely up to me. But that unsettled things, so after that my father came and collected us and we went back to Yarmouth and stayed there for the rest of the war. As a family, because before that my mother was also evacuated to Nottingham with my sister, whereas my father had to stay in Yarmouth and work. I forget what they called the order, where you were directed to work in certain places. And so I think we got to the point where, well, no matter what, Hitler or any of his minions are going to try to do to us. We'll be together as a family. And we just all went back.
Had you been evacuated on the 1st of September 1939?
No. No, because I can remember at the beginning of the war, sitting on a wall, looking out to sea at a drifter and watching a German bomber trying to hit it. And we thought this was a very good show. Now, there was the period, I think they called it the Phony War, when very little happened. We were not evacuated until, I think, after the first or second bombing raid on Yarmouth. And then my parents thought possibly it was a good idea to get us out of the way.
So that was 1940, was it? It
could well have been, yeah. Yes, it could well have been.
So were you well treated as an evacuee, do you think?
Oh, certainly. I think we were treated in the way in which we deserved. We were certainly no angels. And I had a penchant for eating powdered milk. And the first Mrs. Johnson, incidentally we stayed with two Mrs. Johnsons, but the first Mrs. Johnson cured me of it. She emptied the powdered milk tin and filled it up with Persil, and I took a big spoonful. Which solved that problem. Yes, I think on the whole we were excellently treated. It takes a lot of doing to take young strangers into your house and look after them like that. But in the main they did as well. I have been back 25 years ago now, but at that time both of the Mrs. Johnsons were dead. I met the husbands in both cases and the daughter of the first one, and I met the son of the second one. He was then married and living in the old farmhouse, but there was no contact beyond that.
Was the war a happy or an unhappy time for you?
I think overall it was happy. A pervading sense of excitement. Something was always going to happen the next day. And I can remember odd things, a plane that crashed on a training mission, and everybody rushing, and they put tapes up around the field to stop you going near it. And probably not a thing that you should remember, somebody died, but every day something different was happening, and you felt alive, everything was moving.
Any celebrations you remember at the end of the war?
Funnily enough, no. The only thing I really remember was the government British news showing us what was going on in Trafalgar Square. Not Trafalgar Square, outside Buckingham Palace. I don't really remember the celebrations at home, but I presume that they danced along the seafront. That was the normal event, but I can't really say that I recall any of it.
How did you come to be in the army yourself?
Well, I knew that I was going to be conscripted, and I desperately wanted to go in the Black Watch. My father had served in the Highland Brigade. I think he was actually in the Sea Force. But I'd always wanted to be a Black Watch, so I thought, well, if I volunteer, so I was 17 and a half, and I volunteered, and I got accepted into the Black Watch. That was in, I think, November 1948.
Why the Black Watch?
I believed then, and I believe today, that it's the finest regiment in the world. And I just wanted to be in the Black Watch.
But I'm surprised that a Norfolk lad should have heard of it.
Oh, I think that's a misconception that a lot of people have. The Black Watch was, in my platoon at one time, we had Englishmen, a guy from Jersey, a guy from Canada, a lad who was half French. There obviously there were quite a lot of Scotsmen, but there was a high percentage of other nationalities in the regiment. And the regiment rises above nationalities.
So how did you go about joining?
Well, that in its own was quite an adventure. I received a movement order, and I got as far as London, and I lost my ticket. So somebody, I saw a policeman, and he told me you had to go to this RTO. I had no idea what an RTO was, but anyway, they pointed me in the right direction. And decided to keep me in London overnight. They found me a billet at Brinston Square. I think mainly because by then I'd missed the train to Inverness. I was on my way to Fort George to do my basic training. And I eventually arrived at Fort George 3 days late. And the platoon sergeant, who was to become our basic instructor, made quite a point of saying how much harder I'd got to work in the usual sergeant's gentle tones to catch up with the 3 days that I'd missed. And I did my basic training in Fort George, which in itself was an experience.
Tell me about it.
Suddenly you were faced with disciplines and an awareness of people that you hadn't had previously. There were some guys who couldn't even tie their bootlaces, never mind make their beds or darn their socks. There was one at least who didn't understand the necessity for washing. I think after 3 weeks we gave him a dry scrub to solve that problem. I think being put down amongst a load of other guys from all over the country when you'd come from your own closed environment was very good. I always thought it was one of the better aspects for national servicemen. It took them away from mummy and it brought them into the realities of the world and the attitudes of other people. Again, for me, in many ways, it was a happy experience. I suppose memory plays tricks and you tend to forget what were the darker moments. But overall, I quite enjoyed it. And at the end of my basic training, we got leave. I do remember for the first 4 weeks, you weren't allowed out of camp, which seemed a bit, gave you the idea you'd been put in prison rather than in the army. But once we were allowed to go out and I had my first leave, the whole aspect changed. Then I got posted to Canoosti, to a cadet camp. They used to bring groups of cadets from various schools to do a fortnight, and I was sent down there on the permanent staff. Funnily enough, I don't even remember now what I was doing. I don't remember what role they gave me to play there, but I know I was down there. Somewhere in between it, I was taken on to a guard of honour for the Queen Mother and Princess Margaret at Kelvin Hall in Glasgow. We were given 4 days drill and issued with HLI uniforms, because to all intents and purposes the HLI didn't exist at that time. Their NCOs and officers were running the Highland Group Training Centre at Fort George, but they didn't really have enough men to mount a guard of honour. So they just grabbed a load of us and gave us HLI uniforms, sent us down. We thought it was very funny because the Queen Mother was coming along and stopping at various people and shaking hands and saying, "How long have you been in the army?" And he would say, "6 weeks, ma'am." "And how long have you been in the HLI?" "2 days, ma'am." And I think almost everyone she spoke to had only been in the HLI 2 days. But then after that, I was sent to the School of Infantry as a clerk in the NCO's tactical wing. I forget what term they use for the posting there, but you had difficulty in getting away from it. To get out of it, the only choices were either to go in the paratroops or the military police at that time. I chose the paratroops. I did the para course, and I had an accident and badly damaged the ligaments in my left leg and left ankle, and they suggested I return to the regiment for a period as I wouldn't be fit for duties. So I went and joined the battalion in Berlin.
Which battalion was that?
1st Battalion, Black Watch in Berlin at Montgomery Barracks, the former SS barracks in Kladow. I think I was there for must have been about 4 months, and then we were moved down to Buxtehude near Hamburg, and I was supposed to wait 9 months before I go back to the paratroop. I was in two minds whether I want to go back or not. In the end, we got warned for Korea, and I decided not to go back because I thought everybody would think I was a coward and was running out because of Korea. We came home. By then, I'd been put in the signal platoon, and I was a lance corporal. We came home to Crail in Scotland to reform. We were given a leave. And the Queen Mother came to visit us. Then we were bundled off to Korea.
How did you feel about going to Korea?
Well, I certainly wasn't imbued with a high spirit of the United Nations or fighting for mankind. I think, if anything, my attitude was, well, I'm a black jock. The regiment's going to Korea, I'm going with it. I think, I don't know if this applied to everybody, but certainly as far as I was concerned, the regiment was everything. You were there because you were part of the regiment. And these high ideals that one attributes to various men, I wouldn't have volunteered for Korea. I was in Korea because, in my opinion, I had no choice. My regiment was going, therefore I was going. And we went. June 52. We sailed on the Orwell. Not a lot of incident on the journey. Odd things. We sailed at noon, I remember. So we didn't see very much the first day. We were no sooner out to sea than it was dark. I think the first thing we really saw was Gibraltar. Then we went through the Med. We got to Port Suez. We weren't allowed off the boat. We had all the bum boats coming around us and playing around. Then we went down the Red Sea. The first time we got off was at Aden. And we had about 3-4 hours ashore at Aden. And then we were off again. Colombo was the next stop. And we got the best part of a day there. Then to Singapore, and about the same type of leave there. Then after that, they must have decided they were in a hurry because we went to Hong Kong and weren't allowed off the boat. And then sailed straight out again on to Busan. And literally, we got off the boat at Busan. There was a big American band, military band, mostly of, I don't know whether I should say black troops or coloured troops, but they were, and they were playing the American Patrol, the Glenn Miller heated up version, and we marched straight to the station, railway station, and we sat there waiting for a train. I think the only memory I've got of that is the toilets, which were communal, and the cubicles, the top half was glass, so that you could see whether there was anybody in there or not. And it was a cause of great hilarity, for guys kept coming out and saying, there's another one. You'd all run in to see these women sitting in the toilet. It was at an age when I suppose that seemed to be an attraction. Then we caught the train. We went up. I can't remember the position we took, but we had a fortnight, 2 weeks, that they call acclimatization, when you were supposed to get used to the weather and one thing and another. And then we took up our first position on 159.
Was it still summer?
Yes, it would have been July. We sailed in June, not July. It was July when we went into the line.
I think you said it was June, actually.
Did I? Mm.
So your first time in the line was on Hill 159?
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was remarkable in many ways. I said earlier when I was talking about the World War how it helped me, and this is the point at which it helped me. Hill 159 had three small hills in front that were occupied by, I think, A, B and D companies. One hill behind the three that was held by C Company, who were the reserve company. And then from there you had a long straight road running up and over a hill, a mountain, 159. And at the back of this was the headquarters. By that time I was signals corporal, and we used to have to run lines out to all the companies. But going over the top of this hill to go down to Charlie Company was a road that was known as the Million Dollar Mile. It was a mile long and dead straight and in full view of the enemy. And their great delight as you come over the top was to try to catch you with mortars on your way down. All the guys in Charlie Company used to sit outside their hoochies, protected with their little hill at their back, laughing and joking and running a book on whether we were going to make it to the bottom or not. I think that's about all I remember of 159. After that, we were in and out of the line various times. I don't really remember.
What conditions were you living under personally?
Oh, we were living in, we call them hoochies. Hole in the ground was a hole in the ground with sandbags and other things on top, if you could do it. If possible, they used to run a bulldozer around the side of the room, the hill, cutting out a road and leaving a sheer cliff face. And so you used to dig into that. That way you got the whole of the hill above you as protection. Dig into it, enlarge it inside, put sandbags at the door, and used to make our beds out of angle iron, and in our case, being signalers, we used signal wire to lace up a net inside this angle iron frame and thus make our beds.
Lace up a net?
Yeah.
Make a net, you mean?
Make a net, yeah. Sorry, the term lacing comes from my youth in Yarmouth when they used to lace the nets for the herring boats. And it was cold and it was wet, and you went sometimes a long time when you couldn't take your clothes off. You'd have to get up for stand to at early hours of the morning. You'd be out on line and it would be wet, and if there was anything happening that night, you might not get a chance to take your clothes off. Certainly, you, when you're on line, you tended not to get into your sleeping bag if you could avoid it. You laid down and covered yourself all with it. Stories were very rife of the Gloucesters a little while before as having been caught in their sleeping bags. Probably was rumour, but you were aware of it, so you didn't relax yourself at that point.
Were there any vermin or rats?
Oh yeah, one tends to forget about them. I think almost every hoochie had rats in it. We did for a time used to shoot them. But that proved to be a sport that could be dangerous. You might just, there might be somebody walking past outside as you put a bullet through the wall at a rat. That they were there. The vermin, I know. There was ringworm. Not vermin, but I think caused by them. And there was something else, a hemorrhagic fever that was caused by a mite that used to get into the, forgotten the name for the leg wrappings we used.
Putties?
Yes, putties. They would get in behind the putties where it was warm and damp. And it was the big fear, because at that time was no known cure for it. I personally don't know anybody who died from it, but it was the big fear story at the time.
Were you fed properly?
Oh, food was excellent. There were times when you...